Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It is Thursday.
The Colts in session.
July 11th, 2013.
Here come the judge.
Here come the judge.
Stop beating that fudge. Cause here come the judge. Don't nobody budge. Cause here come the judge.
There are two trials in which the defense rested on Wednesday. One got a lot of media coverage all over the TV as the defense of George Zimmerman in the killing of Trayvon Martin. The defense rested in Sanford, Florida. Meanwhile, in Fort Meade, Maryland, very little media coverage as the defense rested, and surprisingly quickly, in the court-martial proceedings of Private Bradley Manning. Now, as you know, if you're a regular listener of these parts, I have not spent much time talking about the Zimmerman trial. In fact, recently, as I put up my daily post about the podcast, I said that if you wanted salacious information about the Zimmerman trial and other tabloid news, you could go to hell. And I hyperlinked the word hell to TMZ.com. I don't know if any of you got that joke, but I got a kick out of it. But to me, while the Zimmerman trial raises some significant issues, and I don't dismiss the racism, the stand your ground law, the whole context in Florida, it's a local case. It became national because of the racial implications and because Trayvon Martin's family and friends demanded justice when it appeared that there wouldn't even be much of an investigation, much less a prosecution. And I have loosely followed the proceedings. It appears to me that it's going to be difficult to win a murder conviction. And I understand that today the judge signaled that the jury will be given a manslaughter option. That said, the issues in the Bradley Manning case are so much more significant. And 5 years, 10 years from now, unfortunately, the Trayvon Martin murder will be largely forgotten. And perhaps the Bradley Manning case will be largely forgotten, but I doubt it. And while the big corporate outlets have only parachuted in for key moments of the proceedings at Fort Meade, Maryland, we've brought you considerable coverage here, and we will do it again tomorrow as Kevin Gostola, who has been live blogging the proceedings at FireDogLake.com, will return to update us on the defense presentation. Now, it is surprising that it only lasted for 3 days and that David Coombs only called 9 witnesses. And, of course, Bradley Manning did formally tell the judge that he will not be testifying. And some of this is kind of clear to me as a defense strategy. But I do have questions that I'll take up with Kevin Gostola in our conversation tomorrow. The questions I have are that we were told that the defense might call as many as 46 witnesses. And there are times when the defense decides not to continue its presentation because it might be enhancing the prosecution, which has failed to prove its case. Unfortunately, in the Manning situation, it's a pretty cold, clear outcome because he has already admitted that he was the source of the transfer of data to WikiLeaks. So the trial is about his motive and about whether he violated the Espionage Act, whether he aided and abetted an enemy, those sorts of things. And so I'm scratching my head because it seems to me that the more exculpatory information that the defense can present, likely the shorter sentence will be meted out to Private Manning. But I'm not there, and I won't second-guess David Coombs. I think from every account, he's done the best possible job in defending Manning. And what limited coverage we've seen, for example, from the Associated Press that appeared in my local paper, the San Francisco Chronicle, referenced the prosecution decision, or position, I'm sorry, that members of Al-Qaeda, including Osama bin Laden, quote, reveled in WikiLeaks' publication of classified U.S. documents, urging members to study them before devising ways to attack the U.S. Now, the AP story may have been longer and was cut to fit the space available in the Chronicle. But what the Chronicle saw fit to publish is only half the story. Because there's clear testimony that it was the reaction of the U.S. government to WikiLeaks that brought to Osama bin Laden's attention the fact that these leaks existed. And it's that kind of coverage that can really get me boiling, because it's only half of the truth or half of the testimony that's been presented. Also, Colonel Morris Davis, who's been on this program, a former prosecutor at Guantanamo, said that most of the information related to Gitmo released via WikiLeaks was already public information. And so we'll get much more from Kevin Gostola on our in-depth interview tomorrow. But I remain much more interested in the Bradley Manning trial than the George Zimmerman trial. A new article from Glenn Greenwald and his team at The Guardian. Today, zeroing in on the PRISM program and how Microsoft and some other companies responded to government demands for access to computer networks and internet systems. The article states Microsoft has collaborated closely with U.S. intelligence services to allow users' communications to be intercepted, including helping the NSA to circumvent the company's own encryption. This according to top-secret documents obtained by The Guardian, provided by Ed Snowden. And here are the key bullet points. Microsoft helped the NSA to circumvent its encryption to address concerns that the agency would be unable to intercept web chats on Outlook. The agency already had pre-encryption stage access to email on Outlook, including Hotmail. The company worked with the FBI this year to allow the NSA easier access via PRISM to its cloud storage service, SkyDrive, which now has more than 250 million users. If you're one of them, your information is not private. Microsoft also worked with the FBI's data intercept unit to, quote, understand potential issues with a feature in Outlook that allows users to create email aliases. Skype, which was bought by Microsoft in October 2011, worked with intelligence agencies before Microsoft bought it and continued last year to allow PRISM to collect video of conversations and audio. And material collected through PRISM is routinely shared with the FBI and CIA, and one NSA document described the program as a team sport. Doesn't that make you feel good? Microsoft defends its actions with weasel words. It only provides customer data in response to government demands, and we only ever comply with orders for requests about specific accounts or identifiers. Well, that's not true, because blanket orders from the secret FISA court allow these communications to be collected without an individual warrant if the NSA operative has a 51% belief that the target is not a U.S. citizen and is not on U.S. soil at the time. So, next time you start a Skype session, it may help your legal position to say, "Hi, I'm an American, I'm in the United States, and this communication is not subject to interception, even if you have a 51% belief that I'm not." Oh. Greenwald's article continues, targeting U.S. citizens does require an individual warrant, but the NSA is able to collect Americans' communications without a warrant if the target is a foreign national located overseas. So, the article describes this program as, and the collaboration with these companies, as deep and ongoing. And it describes, in a timeline way, how at different stages Microsoft has worked with the government to enable and enhance the NSA's access to our communication systems. And so the picture that is emerging is that these companies were probably forced to take these steps, but their denials simply do not hold water. And I'm one of those people who used to think that Skype actually offered a higher level of protection, encryption, than ordinary voice channels on AT&T or, you know, Verizon. But it turns out that's no longer correct. And over at the ACLU, technology expert Chris Chagoyan said the revelations would surprise many Skype users. In the past, Skype made affirmative promises to users about their inability to perform wiretaps. It's hard to square Microsoft's secret collaboration with the NSA with its high-profile efforts to compete on privacy with Google. And there's another story that is in today's Guardian newspaper about how American internet companies charge the government to conduct wiretaps and other surveillance efforts, because Google charges $25 and up per email. Over at AT&T, they have a $325 activation fee for each wiretap and $10 a day to maintain it. At Verizon, they get top dollar, $775 for the first month. That includes installation and activation. And $500 each month after that. I wonder if, you know, like our cell phone contracts, if there's a penalty for early cancellation. And it was a few years ago that I learned that Facebook generates revenue by processing warrants and other requests from government agencies, including local cops, to access user information, Facebook pages. It is a revenue source. And these are billion-dollar revenue companies, but the government is spending hundreds of millions of dollars a year to buy this information. You never hear that debated in the emotional Sturm und Drang about our budget deficit, do you? No, not so much. Top Spook General Keith, that was Spook, Top Spook General Keith Alexander is once again going to speak to a hacker conference in Las Vegas. This time it'll be the group called Black Hat. Last year he went to DEF CON, and they have explicitly uninvited him to return. While he was at DEF CON last year, General Alexander made the comment that, let me find it here, the story that we have millions or hundreds of millions of dossiers on people is absolutely false. Well, maybe the word dossiers in there is the term that allows him to say it's absolutely false. They call them files. And not dossiers. And this is where Senator Ron Wyden got wind of the lies that Keith Alexander and James Clapper, the top spook, routinely tell in public. Meanwhile, there's a guy from Hilliard, Ohio. His name is Clayton Seymour. He's 36 years old. He's an IT guy. And he recently sent a Freedom of Information Act request to the NSA, asking about whether they have a dossier or even a file on him. The letter he got reads like this. Although the programs you reference have been publicly acknowledged, details about them remain classified and protected from release by statutes to prevent harm to the national security of the United States. To the extent that your request seeks any metadata, call data, records on you, or any telephone numbers provided in your request, blah, 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 the answer's no. So, nice try there, Clayton Seymour. But I don't think you're going to get too far. In our in-depth interview released to subscribers today at peterbcollins.com, we talk with Jason Leopold, the intrepid investigative reporter who's focused a lot on Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. We talk about the two court rulings that came down this week, including one today, that orders the commandant of the camp to roll back the extreme body search and genital search measures that were imposed over the last couple of months. We also talk about the very critical ruling by Judge Gladys Kessler, who pointed a finger directly at President Obama. And we talk about the case that Leopold has studied in depth, including the most recent release of documents related to an autopsy and an inquisition into the death of a man held from Yemen called Adnan Latif. Here's an excerpt from my conversation with Jason Leopold.
Yes, it's these two rulings are or opinions are very, very important. The difference between what came out today, just moments ago, Peter, is one, Judge Lamberth in D.C., federal court judge, ruled invalid the aggressive policies that have been put into place earlier this year following a raid at Guantanamo to separate these hunger strikers. What Judge Gladys Kessler said in her opinion on Monday, it's very significant. She ultimately kicked the can, or the ball, so to speak, over to Obama, President Obama, and said, look, you're the commander-in-chief. You can stop this this force feeding that's taking place. So she essentially said that she didn't have any real authority to act on it. Royce Lamberth, however, has, and that is truly significant.
That's Jason Leopold. You can read his entire collection of articles about Adnan Latif at pubrecord.org. And he is now reporting as a freelancer for Al Jazeera. In the second segment of today's interview podcast, we speak with Cynthia Papermaster. She's an American activist from Berkeley, right across the bay from me here in California. And she is in day 27 of her own personal hunger strike in solidarity with the inmates at Guantanamo and in the prison system here in the state of California. It's inspiring to hear her speak about this and call for you to honor her hunger strike by contacting the White House and urging President Obama to do the right thing. Over in the House of Representatives today, where John Boehner still has egg on his face, or maybe it's a cow pie, for failing to count the votes on an attempt to pass the farm bill a couple of weeks back. So today they stripped out all the food stamp part of it, and the House was able to pass the remnants of the farm bill. Now, this creates problems because they'll try to reconcile this with a Senate bill. Because there's absolutely no language about food stamps, it's unclear what'll happen. The House says they'll return and vote on a food stamp bill later. In the meantime, over 45 million Americans, Boehner and the Republicans say let them eat snake. Across Capitol Hill in the Senate chambers, a little bit of good news to start off. Elizabeth Warren, the new senator from Massachusetts, joined forces with John McCain, the most popular guest on the Sunday talk shows, to introduce a bill that is the 21st century version of the Glass-Steagall Act. And it's about time. Fundamentally, Glass-Steagall separated investment banks from consumer banks and prevented crossing the line so that our money could be used to bet on Wall Street casino games. So we'll watch this one and see if it progresses intact in the Senate. There's also a bill sponsored by Sherrod Brown of Ohio and David Vitter, the hooker lover from Louisiana, Democrat and Republican respectively, called Terminating Bailouts for Taxpayer Fairness Act of 2013, designed to tackle the problem of too big to fail banks. We'll keep an eye on those pieces as time continues here, goes on. And they're trying to blow up part of the filibuster in the Senate. And once again, Harry Reid is just so damn timid. Because he is taking a risk, I've acknowledged this, to change the rules of the Senate risks a kind of payback if and when the Republicans become the majority in the future. But the risk to me is the same. Whether you end the filibuster and reduce it to 51 votes, 55 votes instead of 60. But what the Democrats are doing is saying, well, you can still filibuster a judicial nominee or any piece of legislation. But it would prevent Republicans from allowing minority rule or blocking confirmation of presidential appointees to the cabinet and other executive branch positions. And, this is a half step, and if it happens, it'll be, you know, better than what we have now. And in the face of this threat, Republicans have been saying, well, if you promise not to use the so-called nuclear option, we will take our proverbial boot off the windpipes of nominees like Gina McCarthy at the EPA or Thomas Perez as Labor Secretary. But we've got the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the National Labor Relations Board, the Federal Elections Commission. There are many important bodies that are unable to act or to operate legally because the Senate won't confirm nominees. And I also believe that judicial nominees, particularly the way it's handled now, should not be subject to filibusters. There's already a process where a senator can put a hold on a nomination, and I think that is plenty of power. We'll see. Harry Reid was scheduled to have a closed-door lunch with the Democratic members of the Senate to discuss this. We'll see what they come up with. Another bad deal coming out of the Senate related to the student loan rates that jacked up by 100% the Stafford loans on July 1st. And the whole structure of student loans is so wrong. For people to come out of college and have $100,000 or $200,000 or $300,000 in student debt is unconscionable. Instead of fixing that problem, we're going to continue to limp along and we're going to increase the interest rates on the balance of student loans. They have a complicated formula based on the cost of federal money plus a certain number of percentage points. But the bottom line is that we should be investing in the future of the student population and not saddling them with huge liabilities when and if they can graduate. It is simply wrong. One more item from the Guardian newspaper in London, and I didn't see this in any American paper today. They did a study of Obama's appointments of ambassadors. And yes, they go to the people who raised boatloads of money for his presidential campaigns. Topping it off is a guy named Matthew Barzun, B-A-R-Z-U-N. He raised over $700 million for Obama. $2.3 million of it was personally raised by him, and his reward is he gets an appointment to be the ambassador to the Court of St. James, that is, the ambassador to the United Kingdom. And he's going to get to kiss Kate and Will's baby only because he bundled and raised all that money for Obama. So these are clear ambassadorships for sale. The new ambassador to Italy is John Phillips, a Washington lawyer who raised at least $500,000. Ambassador to Germany, John Emerson, an L.A. fund manager, raised $1.5 million. Heiress Jane Stetson, frontrunner for the embassy job in Paris, she raised $2.4 million for Obama. The average per donor is $1.8 million. It's pretty ugly. And what really burns me is that Don Siegelman, the former Democratic governor of Alabama, languishes today in federal prison. And if you've listened to the podcast interviews with him, with his co-defendant Richard Scrushy, with Roger Shuler, and other experts on the Siegelman case, he didn't bribe anybody. He never got any money. He didn't give any money. And the whole case against him is based on a phony house of cards and the political interests of Karl Rove and his friends. Siegelman was convicted of bribery, of accepting a bribe. And yet these routine appointments of ambassadors who've raised oodles of campaign cash draw no notice, no legal repercussions. Yes, Washington is for sale. I'd like to buy me the ambassadorship to a nice Caribbean island. Anybody want to loan me a couple of million?
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.